All right, we began discussing the case of Avram destroying the idols.
Right.
Now, we spoke about the fact that it's not such a simple matter that Avram Avinu was able to destroy the idols, and can I just destroy your property, your possessions? That's right. Called a mazik. And the truth of the matter is that we can wonder about the status of Avram Avinu. Was he Yisrael? Was he Ben Noach? And if he was a Ben Noach only has seven mitzvahs, and whether or not the prohibition against damaging someone else's property
right.
would apply to a Ben Noach as well. One of the seven mitzvahs Ben Noach is gzeila, stealing. And the question here is whether or not mazik, to damage someone's property, comes under the iser of gzeila.
Right.
So if you take a look here on the bottom of the first page that you have, or maybe just the top of the page. Again, some of it may have unfortunately got cut off. But it would seem that according to the Ramban, in Brachos Lamed Daled, the mitzvah of dinim, right, to establish courts, which is incumbent upon every non-Jew, includes within it many, many different averos. And he mentions the Zikin as well, damaging. So that according to the Ramban, one would certainly say that Avraham Avinu would have been enjoined from destroying someone else's property, because a non-Jew is not allowed to destroy someone's property, and that's something that comes under dinim.
But if he was a Yisrael, so then he would be obligated to destroy.
Well, if he was a Yisrael, so then there's a mitzvah of destroying idols. There's a special mitzvah of Ibud Avodah Zarah, so that would apply. But we don't find that the Ben Noach, amongst his seven mitzvahs, is obligated to destroy idols. So the question therefore arises, why would Avraham Avinu be allowed to destroy idols? So you see a paragraph that starts by Nira Lomar?
183?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So, what I try to suggest here in this paragraph is that Avodah Zarah is what's called Isurei Hanoah, means you're not allowed to enjoy any benefit from an object that was worshipped. As the Gemara says in Masechta Makis towards the end, and the Rambam at the beginning of the seventh parak of Hilchos Avodas Kochavim, this Isur Hanoah would seem to apply to a Ben Noach as well. Because the Rambam writes in Hilchus Malachim Perek Tes, Afal Pisheino Nerag Osur Bakol, meaning that all the prohibitions that come under Avodah Zarah apply to Ben Noach. He'll only get executed if he commits the most serious crime, namely if he worships the idol. But nevertheless, the other benefits are prohibited as well under the Iser of Avodah Zarah. So one could say that once the idol is prohibited in Hanoah, you're not allowed to have any benefit from it, then there's no ownership over the idol. And this comes under a general principle in Halacha that anything that's Osur B'Hanoah is not yours. It doesn't belong to you, because one of the facets of ownership is the fact that I have the rights to use it and to enjoy it. But if I can't enjoy it and it becomes Yisurei Hanoah, then it's not mine. If that be the case, then there's no Yisur Mazik, because the prohibition against damaging someone is damaging property that he owns. But if that possession is Yisurei Hanoah, he's not allowed to enjoy it and he doesn't own it, so if I don't cause you any loss, and perhaps there would be no avera. In any event, to move on to another topic, we want to discuss Shem V'Aver. I mean, Shem V'Aver were great thinkers and believers. They, according to Chazal, they established some sort of yeshiva. We don't hear much about them. We hear a lot about Avraham Avinu going out there and projecting the belief in one God, but we don't hear much about Shem V'Aver.
Weren't they the people who just sat in the basement and didn't actually do anything?
They didn't go out. They seem to be sitting in the basement. The Ravid in Hilchos Akum at the very beginning, Perek Alpha Lachim Gimel, is bothered by this. He says, "V'tamea ani, I'm in amazement, in wonderment. Sharei hayu shom shei v'aver, v'eich lo hayu mochim. How could they not protest against all the idol worship that was so rampant, so widespread at that time? V'efshar, and it's possible, He's just speculating. Ki mochem hayu. Indeed, they made a protest. But v'lo ir lehem sheyishavru es talmehem. But they didn't have the possibility of destroying the idols. Lefisha hayu mischabim mehem. Because they were running away. They were fugitives. Acheba Avram, but Avram was the one who had the power, the gumption, the courage, v'shiber tzalmei aviv, and he destroyed the idols of his father. So there's the Kesef Mishnah, which is the super commentary on the Rambam, who tries to explain the Ravid. And he says, sha'ovdei hatzlonim hichbiu es tzalmeihem. Not the way I interpreted it, which I thought was simple pshat, that they, meaning Sheva Ever, were hiding away because they were afraid that the idol worshippers would destroy them, just like they tried to destroy Avram, but rather that the idol worshippers were hiding away their idols. And that's why they weren't accessible to Shem V'Eber, they couldn't find them. So again, if you go back to the Ravid's language, you can see clearly that there are two ways of reading the Ravid. It says, V'lo ira lahem sheyishperu es salmehem, Lefisha hayu mischavim mehem. You see, the truth is that according to the case of Mishnah's pshat in the Ravid should have said mechavim mehem in an active sense. Mischavim means they hid themselves. So I don't know if he has a slightly different girsa perhaps in the text of the Ravid. So the question is, how do we understand the personalities of Shem Vever and their seeming lack of response to this whole thing? And basically, the way the Ravid has it, they couldn't find the idols. They were hidden from them. And the Kesef Mishnah goes on to say, "Vzu eino taina, sharei nimrod v'chol malchuso befarhesya hayu ovdim hatzlomim." He can't begin to fathom the words of the Ravid that the idols were hidden from sight. We know from all the statements of Chazal that the entire country was worshipping idols. Even Nimrod the king himself would publicly worship idols and Avodah Zorah. So to say that, you know, that Shem V'Eiver were prevented from destroying the idols because they couldn't find them, that's very difficult. And the Kesef Mishnah goes on to say, "B'nei Adam ayu mochrim slamim b'chanuyot." There were special stores for selling idols. It's like in our time, we have stores that sell things that you might call idols, you know, different kinds of stores. But in those times, there were definitely idol worshippers that were selling idols publicly. So it's very difficult, says the Kesef Mishnah, to embrace the Ravid's opinion that Shem V'Eiver couldn't find the idols. But we would suggest a different pshat, that if we go back to what we think is simple pshat in the Ravid, Shem V'Eiver were hiding from the Ovdei Avodah Zorah. Because take a look at the Medrash in Tehillim, which is quoted here by Avodas HaMelech. The Avodas HaMelech was a great commentary on the Rambam, on the first Chelek we have. The rest was destroyed during the war. But it says in the Medrash, which is quoted by the Avodas HaMelech, "Hamisha tzaddikim hayu ba'olam." At that time there were five great tzaddikim. There was Noach, there was Shem V'Eiver, there was a fellow by the name of Ashur, and there was Avraham. Noach lo kapit. Noach was not interested. He didn't get involved. He wasn't going to make a big splash, you know, a big protest against the idol worshippers. He was beinolo beinatzmo. He was kind of just completely apathetic, if you will. Shem V'Eiver hitminu es atzmam. They hid themselves. What does it mean? It means that they were afraid for their own lives. They would have gone out there to destroy the idols just that Avram did, but they didn't have the courage to do so.
I'm kind of confused. Can I ask a question?
Yeah, please.
We left the last paragraph, but I didn't necessarily understand. I know we're on a new topic now. So what exactly was... So we didn't establish whether Avram was a B'nai Noach or Yisrael, right?
Right.
We just said that by B'nai Noach that it was a mitzvah for them to destroy the idols too, right?
No, that's not what we're saying. We're saying the mitzvah to destroy idols is only incumbent on Yisrael. And if Avram had the status of Yisrael, then for sure he could destroy the idols. He would have to destroy the idols.
Uh-huh.
But as a B'nai Noach, there's no mitzvah to destroy idols. Once there's no mitzvah to destroy idols, then the question arises, what permission, what license did Avram have to destroy someone else's property? Now, you could either say that destroying someone's property is not one of the Zion mitzvahs b'nei Noah, but then you're contradicting the Ramban, who says that even a ben Noach is not allowed to destroy someone else's property. Or the other way you could say it is that nobody owned these idols. I'm not allowed to, even a ben Noach is not allowed to destroy your possessions, but if you don't possess them, then there is no prohibition. Why is it that you make an idol and you don't possess it? And the answer is because idols are Yisurei Hano. And the principle is Yisurei Hano Lav Mamonhu. Meaning that once the Torah prohibits you from enjoying any benefit from something, then you lose, you forfeit your ownership rights on that. That's a principle which we could discuss for hours and hours and hours.
You know, if you're a B'nai Noach, you're saying.
Yeah, no. Regardless. It has nothing to do with B'nai Noach. The question of B'nai Noach is whether B'nai Noach have the Yisur HaNoah and Avodah Zarah.
Yeah, okay.
That I tried to indicate from the Rambam in Hilchos Melachim Perek Tes, who says that Afal Pishenu Nerag Aser, meaning that all Yisur Avodah Zarah apply to a B'nai Noach as they do to Yisrael.
Okay.
Now, if you accept that premise, which you may question, then you could say the second premise that you can't own something that's osur by Noach. If Ben Noach is not allowed to enjoy benefit from it, his status of possession is the same as Yisrael. There's no difference.
Okay.
In Bailus, in ownership, it doesn't make any difference whether you're Yisrael or you're a guy, as long as you have such a thing as Yisurei Hano. For example, there's a whole issue about Eiver Menachai, which is one of the Sheva Mitzvahs Bnei Noach, whether it's osur by Noach or not. Because we have a principle that whenever the Torah prohibits achila, then hana is included in that achila. That's the sugya at the beginning of the second parak of Psofet.
Yeah, but you own the animal.
Who owns the animal? If it's also about hana. I'm talking if you pluck out an aver.
Right. So why would it be?
And the animal's alive.
And it'll be azur.
If it would be also about hana, then the Ben Noach would not allow to enjoy any benefit in the Eifer. He wouldn't be allowed to feed it to his dog.
So why is there a separate mitzvah Ben Noach not to Terry? It seems redundant.
Why is there a special mitzvah for Ben Noach?
Right.
Well, I'm not saying this is special. Ben Noach has seven mitzvahs, one of which is Eifer Menachai. We also have Eifer Menachai. But our Eifer Menachai is Mutter Ben Noach. And that's based on a Hekish to Dam. Right? And the Hekesh, according to Psalm, doesn't apply to a Ben Noach. He's not included in that Hekesh. So in the case of Ben Noach, we go back to the original rule that anything that's prohibited in Achila is automatically prohibited in Hana until the Torah goes in and says you're allowed to have Hana. For example, in the Vela. The Torah says that you're not allowed to eat in the Vela, but we assume that unless the Torah would permit Hana from the Vela, I couldn't even feed it to my dog. But the Torah says, like Ger Asher B'Sherecha Titnena, that you're allowed to give it to your dog.
Nevela is what again?
By nevela, the Torah says, lo sochu kol nevela. You're not allowed to eat it.
So what is a nevela?
Like nevela is an animal that dies without shechita.
Okay.
So the meat is osur. And the Gemara says that it would have been osur b'hana, even though the Torah only prohibits you in the explicit pasuk from achila, it would nevertheless be osur b'hana, except that the Torah went ahead and said, la ger asher b'sherecha titnenu, that you're allowed to give it to a ger. Which in this case, for our purposes, means a non-Jew. A non-Jew is allowed to eat nevela. He has no bits of shechita. But be that as it may, again, this is a whole pilpul, it's a whole shir unto itself. The bottom line is that some hold that an Avram and a Chai for a Ben Noach is Yisuri Hanoh. That means if an animal is alive and you pluck one of its limbs off, you can't even feed that to your dog. You can't have any benefit from it. A guy I'm talking about. I'm not talking about a Jew. I'm talking about a guy. A Jew is allowed to feed Avram and Achai to his dog. But a guy, according to this particular sheet, is not allowed to.
Why?
Because Avram, because again, there's certain drushos that were given to Yisrael that weren't given, certain yalfusos, you know, derivations. One of those derivations is called the Hekesh. So the Hekesh between Avram and Achai and Dam teaches us, it's a sugi in Chulin somewhere, don't ask me exactly what daf, because I don't remember. But based on that Hekesh, we derive the conclusion that just like the Torah says you're allowed to have benefit from Dam, he's just not allowed to eat it or drink it, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
So too, the same law applies to Avram and Achai. But that Hekesh doesn't have any relevance, any bearing to a Ben Noach, and therefore he's also Ben Noach. I don't want to get into this now. I'm just trying to show you that there may be Isuri Hanoh for Ben Noach.
Yeah.
And if there are Isuri Hanoh, then the rule that'll kick in is that Isuri Hanoh ain't no mama. I can't claim damages from you if you destroyed something that's osur b'hanon. For example, let's say I cook milk and meat together. Mm. So that mixture is called isurei hanon. I'm not allowed to have any benefit. I can't feed it to my dog. I can't give it to a guy. I can't do anything. Suppose you come along and you destroy it. You throw it into the incinerator. You burn it to a crisp. Can I sue you for damages under the law of Nezikin? The answer is no. Why? Because the Surei Hano Lav Mon. You can't say that you possess something that's Osir Hano. If that be the case, then perhaps this is the answer to our question that bothers our mind. How is Avram running around destroying the idols? The Rambam says, V'shiver Atzlomen. I mean, Rashi quotes at the end of Parshas Noach, a Medrash that says that Avram did a whole shtick, a whole to-do with his father's idols. You know, he put the axe in the arm of the biggest idol and said, he told his father that he destroyed all the other idols, it wasn't me. Mm-hmm. So how's he allowed to do that? That was a fascinating question that somehow, you know, engaged my mind. And I thought that maybe the answer might be that Avodah Zarah is also about not only to Yisrael, but also to a guy. And if Yisrael no lav mamon, then maybe there was no prohibition against Hezek to damage something which is Osir Manon. That's all. I would love to go on, because I think we have more exciting things to talk about tonight. And it's right. Already getting late. So, but it's up to you if you want to discuss this weekend.
Would Abraham be going against Gibudah then?
I don't think so. I'll tell you why. Because, first of all, you're assuming this is complicated. I don't know that a guy is mitzvah kibud av va'em. It's not one of the seven mitzvahs, but I know.
The story in the Gemara about Dama Ben.
Vanistina, correct. I thought you were going to say that. Right.
Sorry.
What does it say in the Gemara?
The Gemara says that we derive the paradigm, you know, that to imitate is the person that we should imitate in kibud av va'em. Is Dama Ben Hasini. He was a guy and he didn't wake up his father even though they asked him. You remember that story? But the truth is that we could derive Midos even from a cat. The Gemara tells us that a cat is very Tzanua.
What does that mean?
Sneus is a modesty. The way the cat when it goes to the washroom, you know, whatever it does. So we can learn. You can learn. For example, the Gemara says you can learn amelus from an ant. You know, if you've ever seen the ants, they carry a tremendous amount of stuff on their back, like five times their weight, and they're running around and they're building this and they're building that. You know, so you can learn amelus from an animal, and certainly kolshkin from a human being. That's how little kid. So Dovid Ben Hasina taught us amelus. I wouldn't say that but again, we're getting really off the topic. I would say, just to push you off the cash, you know, that it was not a violation of keeping up for him. On the contrary, what Avram was trying to do was to educate his father. Because one thing that seems to be a premise in almost any religion is that gods don't die. Mm-hmm. A deity doesn't die. The Tzlamim died. They were destroyed. If these idols were destroyed, that was Avram's proof to his father, Terach, that they were not deities. It didn't work in the case of Terach, because he slept his son Avram, after Avram destroyed the idols, all the way up to Nimrod, only to be cast in the furnace of Chazan. But the Rambam seems to indicate that in the propaganda campaign that Avram embarked upon to destroy the idols, he was successful, Avram. And one of the methods that he used to demonstrate that these idols are not gods is by destroying them. Mm. According to one version of Chazal, he threatened to destroy Nimrod, because Nimrod presented himself as a god. So Hashem said, so Avram says to him, I know what to do with you. I'm going to destroy you, and then everyone will see that you're not God. Be that as it may, let's focus for a few minutes, if you have a car, before we just completely end, on Shem V'Yev. Where was Shem V'Yev? So the Kesef Mishnah thought that when he read the Ravid, that Shem V'Yev could not destroy the idols because they were hidden from view. They were hidden deep down under the ground, or in the garages, or in the chimneys. This is a classic in Tanakh. very often in Tanakh, you will find, for example, Yoshia Melech, what the Jews did at that time is they hid their idols, and he didn't know about them. He was very naive, and he didn't believe that they had idols. He thought he had cleaned out all the idols, and there were idols around. Again, we don't have the Yetzer for idol worship, but at the time of the Tanakh, I mean, there was a tremendous Yetzer to worship the idols. But wait, before we... Let me just finish the sentence. So what was I saying? No, because I'm going to lose my trend of thought. I think I already did. What was I want to say? Just one second. That...
Hiding.
Yeah, that according to the Kesef Mishnah, Shem V'Eva couldn't find the idols. Maybe it means they didn't even know there were idols there. I don't know. They couldn't find them. They were hidden. And the Kesef Mishnah rejects this. He says it's not shayach to say what the Ravid says. He literally argues with the Ravid. And he says, this is not true. Nobody was hiding idols. The idols were public.
Right.
It's like Lahavdil, if you talk about Kratzmach. Would you imagine walking down the street in a Christian neighborhood and not seeing Christmas lights or decorations or all over the place? I mean, they're going to start any minute now. You know, we're still in October. I think I saw one house that had some sort of thing on. That's the way the nature of it. These guys like to profess their religion publicly. They like to demonstrate that's part of their religion. The same thing was true for the idol worshipers. The pagans, they used to show off their idols. They sold it publicly. So the Ravid, the way the Kesef Mishnah to the Ravid is very difficult, and the Kesef Mishnah doesn't buy into it. We're suggesting a different reading of the same words of the Rashi. The Kesef Mishnah saw the same words, but we're interpreting them differently. And that is that Shem V'Eva were fugitives. They were afraid. They needed politically, it was very dangerous. See, sometimes a religion is worshipped by the people, but it doesn't become a state religion. In this case, it was a state religion. Nimrod was the king. Any violation of his rule of Avodah Zarah, of idol worship, meant certain death. It was a capital crime. You're going to be thrown into the fiery furnaces, burnt to a crisp. It wasn't pleasant. It wasn't pleasant. It was like the guillotine. It was probably worse than the guillotine. And therefore, we could suggest that Shem V'Eva couldn't stand up to this test. There was no way that they could fight against the entire people. Two people against the entire nation, maybe the entire globe at that time.
But there was also Avram.
Okay, three people. But Avram wasn't going to help them. You know, he didn't have the muscles to protect them against millions and millions of people, against the king. The king had the power. Could you imagine what the king's palace looked like? It was probably surrounded by senators, by people with spears, and who knows what other ammunition they had. It was pretty scary.
How about the four nations?
They were also idol worshippers. I don't know that there were any nations that would tolerate this kind of revolution that Avraham Avinu was trying to generate. So Shem V'Eva did the best they could. They hid away, cloistered themselves up, and protected their own lives. And again, I wouldn't have the guts to say such a pshat in the Ravid, except that it reflects what we see in the Medrash. You remember the Medrash to Ilamiya? It says that there were five tzaddikim. Does this ring a bell? The five tzaddikim? Don't all answer at once. It's in the second paragraph. It says, Chamisha tzaddikim hayu ba'olam, Noach, Shem V'Eva, Ashur, V'Avram. And it says that Shem V'Eva, Hitminu es Atzmon. They hid themselves. That's the translation of Hitminu es Atzmon.
Who is the Ashur?
I don't know. He was one of the good guys at the time. V'ilu Avram, why wasn't he worried about the political repercussions and the danger involved in publicly battling against the idol worshippers? Pirsam, he publicly notified the people that they're doing a very tragic mistake. Vahudia es haderech ha'emes, and he taught the right way, the proper truth. And therefore, we can really understand the difference between Shem V'Eva and Avraham. The Rambam says, Avrama Yekore Umachriz Emunas Hayichut. He would call wherever he went. You know, he had this foghorn, you know, and he would scream out and announce the belief in Yichud, meaning that there's only one God, not this plurality of gods. V'shem v'yever hayumodim derech Hashem litalmideihem. But according to the Kesef Mishnah, Shem v'yever would teach the way of God, but to whom?
Bogren.
Correct, to the students in the yeshiva. Avalonis oreru likro v'lahachriz k'mo Avram. They didn't have the gumption and the energy and the initiative to fight this revolutionary battle against the entire generation. That was left for whom? For Avram. He was the one who would come forward and play that role. And in a sense, my heart goes out for Avram Avinu to put his life, I don't know if you could just imagine what a scene it must have been like when Avram contested against the whole nation, all the peoples on the globe, one individual to fight that battle, and the danger that he put himself into. Because it was a political religion, it was the religion of the state. And they were barbarians. I mean, they could take a person and throw him into a furnace. I mean, we've seen such people even in this day and age. I mean, it's barbarianism. Just, what is it, 60 years ago? So Shem v'Yever, in a sense, what we could say were esoteric. Esoteric means, you know, they were limited in who they would invite. You know, I don't know if you've ever had the exposure to a shir. Somebody offers a shir, but by invitation only.
Right.
Did you ever hear such a thing?
Yeah.
And it means that they're not opening up to everyone. It's not laissez-faire, you know, carte blanche, anyone come in and take a seat. By invitation only. And that's a certain kind of confinement of the teaching of the Torah, the teaching of the truth. Shem v'Yever, according to this particular approach, were in that mode. For whatever reasons you want to justify, you know, I'm not here to judge them. But at the end of the day, we don't hear much about Shem v'Yever. They don't play that much of a role in history. They were great guys, and they had yeshiva, and they had disciples. But they didn't go out. And I'm thinking to myself that maybe this entire episode about Avraham Avinu that's being, you know, projected high profile, so much emphasis on Avraham Avinu, the father of our people, is really coming to teach us something. You know, many people create yeshivas and they learn in yeshivas, but how many people have this sense of going out there, you know, doing outreach and being dedicated to a community? I think I may have told you, but my son was in Portland, Oregon for 2 years, learning in a kollel, and it was also a community project. He lived in a Jewish neighborhood which had thousands upon thousands of Jews, but they had no connection to Judaism at all. One girl who was in that group came to Israel to study for a year on a conservative program, and she came to us for Shabbos very often. And the way she described it, in terms of the classmates of hers in the public school, which is predominantly Jewish in that particular area of Portland, if they marry Jews, it'll be a pure coincidence. That's what she said. A pure coincidence if they marry Jews. So to go out there and create some sort of community-minded program, now here in Toronto, it's a little more challenging. You know, we'd like to be community-minded, but it's difficult. We don't know how to do this. You know, we want to juggle some learning with some outreach or some chesed and really touch the hearts of Jews in Toronto. But the question is how to go about doing that and finding a balance between that and our learning. Avraham Avinu, in his context, represents the epitome of someone who's going to go out there and teach and preach and project the emunah, the truth, and the belief in one God. Now, what about Shem? We know he had a yeshiva. We know he had some influence and some impact. So I'd like to read with you on the bottom of this page, if you have three lines up from the bottom, the Lashon of the Yalkut Shimoni. That's a collection of Midrashim in Parshas Noach. It says, Lo Gilgel HaKadosh Baruch Hu Behevius Avram Li'olam El Bishar Shem. The whole reason that Avram got to live, to be born in this world, is for the merit of his of Shem, who was his great-great-grandfather, right? Shenis Nabe Tough Shana. How much is tough?
9.
No, that's Tess.
400.
For 400 years, he, Shem, was prophesizing, Al Kol Umos HaOlam. Wow, for Lo Kiblu Mimenu. So this is an amazing medrash, because this medrash throws a whole new light on Shem. We thought that Shem behavior were only interested in their talmidim in a very insulated atmosphere, you know, with four walls, and they had their bakrim, and you know, it was like the chesidus tish. That was it. You went to the tish, but there was no... Here, what we're saying is that for 400 years, Shem made every effort to try to reach out to the nations and preach to them, but it just didn't go. He was not successful. So Shem, in fact, was active in trying to publicize the belief in God, but he wasn't successful. Now there's a Mishnah in Avos that speaks about the 10 generations from Noach to Avram. And the Mishnah says that these 10 generations were not worth much. Man reached a low state during that period of time. And then Avram Avinu came and he got the scar for all those 10 generations. Meaning, there was nothing, there was no one who could justify those 10 generations. There's no life, no single life that was worth it, except for one life. And that was the life of Avram. So Rashi on that Mishnah says the following, Lefi, Sha'ad Ata. What does Ad Ata mean?
Until
this point. Until this point, Lo Hayat Tzadik Ba'olam, Kol Kach, at that level, Sheyinchal Chelko V'Chelkom Bi'olam Haba. There was never a Tzadik who was on that level that he could inherit not only his own portion in the world to come, but also the portions of all the other members of his society. Now, take a look at the language of Rashi. Rashi says, "Lefi she'arat lo hayat tzadik ba'olam kol kach." Why is Rashi in the word kol kach? In other words, Rashi is saying that Avram was a greater tzadik than what? Than all the other tzadikim. Who are these other tzadikim? The answer is, apparently, Rashi is intimating that there were other tzadikim in the generation. There was Shem, there was Avra, there was Ashur, but they didn't reach that level of Avram Avinu. So I would say that I think what's going on here in this Rashi is that there's a qualitative difference between Avram as a tzaddik and any other tzaddikim that were around, whether it's Ashur, whether it's Noach, whether it's Shem or Aver. There's a quality. Avram is in his own category. Because Avram is the only great person who is willing to go out there and profess the belief in one God. There are other tzaddikim, but they're not on the same level. Who are these other tzaddikim?
Exactly.
So Shem Ve'er are given a very fine accolade here, an approbation from the Ribbono Shel Olam. He's calling them tzaddikim, but they're not, qualitatively, they're not at all the same tzaddik like Avram was. So basically what I want to convey to you here is that who's considered great in our eyes? Who's considered great in the Torah's eyes? We have today an image of a Talmud Chacham, of a great scholar. Where is he? Just by sheer association. Don't think too long. What?
Avram.
No, no, no. I'm saying we have in our generation today, in the year 2010, we have tzaddikim, and we have an image of these tzaddikim. What do you associate with when you think of the tzaddikim of this year, of this age? They're learning, and they have talmidim, and they're in yeshivas. In the case of Avraham Avinu, we have a whole different image that's being projected about the greatness of Avraham Avinu. It's not so much that he's a great scholar, but rather he's going out there and he's spreading the belief in God to the entire world. Ve'ilu kan, ba'avonas chazal begadlusa shal Avraham lo daibazesh adam gadol bocher li'atzmo. If we're looking for the high level tzaddik, we're not going to find it in those gentlemen who choose for themselves a number of students and disciples, and that's where they put all their energies. Hadargah gdola, but the greater level of a tzaddik, that applies only to a person who is charismatic and leads the other people of his generation to the worship of Almighty God. What's great about Avraham Avinu is his courage, his fortitude, his knowledge, and the fact that he's a teacher. And he's a successful teacher despite all the persecution of a pagan state that he lived in. Nevertheless, Avraham Avinu plays a tremendous role. He's not limited, Avraham, to his numbers of students. He goes out there to the hamonim, to the masses. And perhaps after Matan Torah, the Gdolei Torah were given a different task. It's no longer to teach faith in God for all creatures that have been born, but rather to actively give up one's life for the sake of Torah and its transmission. And therefore it could be that what Chazal is saying about Avraham Avinu and his greatness is that he was willing to literally put his life on the line for the sake of creating this tradition of a belief that would be passed down through the generations of one God. And now I want to talk to you a little bit about the pasuk HaNefesh Asher Asu B'Charon. Do you see that? Mm-hmm. So the Gemara says in Masechta Sanhedrin on Daf Tzadites, Omer Ish Lakish, Kol HaMelamed Es Ben Chaveru Torah, anyone who teaches his friend's son Torah. Right, Jonah?
Yes.
I'm teaching you Torah because you're my friend's son. Right? Is Ma'al of HaKosuv Ki Ilu Aso. The Torah considers it as if he created him.
Right.
As if you're teaching your own son Torah, it says, so you are the biological father, but if you're teaching someone else's son, you're not the biological father. But nevertheless, the Torah considers it as if you were the father of this person. Why? Because you create him spiritually. You give him Torah. And that's called HaNefesh Asher Asu B'Chara. It would seem from the language of Reish Lakish that this pasuk, Vesanefesh Asher Asu B'Charon, is a proof to Gerus. I'm sorry. It is not a proof to Gerus, but rather to Torah. Because look what he's saying. Kol Malamed Es Ben Chaveru Torah. He doesn't say anything about the fact that Hanefesh Asher Asu, meaning he was Megayer them, he converted them. It seems like he taught them Torah. Also, if you take a look in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah Daf Tes, it says Shnei Alofim Torah. When did the period of 2,000 years of Torah? When did it start? When did it begin? With Es HaNefesh Asher Asu B'Chara. There's no mention of Gerus. For example, the Rambam at the beginning of Hilchos Avodas Chacham doesn't say anything about the fact that Avraham was Megayer Es HaNoshim, that he brought the men to convert. And Rabbeinu Bachai on the Poskas, he writes at the end of this whole long paragraph, that all three of us went down the same pathway. Levatel avodah zarah, they did everything in their power to destroy idols. Ulefarseim, and to publicize emunah v'hayichud, to publicize the belief in one God. Once again, if you're careful about reading Rabbeinu Bachai, Rabbeinu Bachai makes no mention, not even a footnote, to Geirus. So what's going on over here? Are we meant to draw the conclusion that there was no Geirus in the full sense of the term during that period of time of Avraham Avinu? It seems like that's the correct conclusion.
How does that make sense, though? Because we learned from Rashi that Avram and Sarai brought souls with them, right? It says in Rashi, and then it says that the Pasha Shal Mikra over there is that they were converting people,
right?
And then it says, well, but we can't assume that, so we have to assume that it meant their servants, their maidservants.
So again, two interpretations of Nefesh Asher Asu B'Chorin. One interpretation is that they were Megayer them, and they went through Geirus. The other interpretation is, if you look in many, many different sources, the concept of Geirus is completely omitted. Reish Lakish says that HaNefesh Asher Asu B'Chorin refers to teaching Torah. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah says HaNefesh Asher Asu B'Chorin was the kickoff of 2,000 years of Torah. Nowhere, and not even in the Rambam, here in Perek Aleph Milchus Akum, is there any hint to this whole process of Geirus that Avraham Avinu was running around being Megayer people. And again, in Rabbeinu Bachai's context, he says, Lomadita Shekola Avos Holchu B'derech Hazeh Levatel Avodah Zarah Ulefarseim Ha'emuna Ve'ayichud, that the Avos followed the footsteps of Avraham, and they did what they had to do in order to be Mevatel Avodah Zarah and to publicize the belief in one God. No mention of Geirus.
There's no Geirus because it's a misopinion. Bein Noach, to know the one God.
Yeah, maybe they were all Bein Noach, but they weren't Geirus. Maybe Geirus didn't come into existence until the time the Torah was given. But it's interesting to note that there are myriads of people, I mean tens of thousands of people, where are these people? You know, not long after this Tkufa, it says that the Bnei Yisrael going to Golos Mitzrayim, Hashivim Nefesh Yardu Avoseinim Mitzrayim. It means Beis Yaakov, the family of Jacob, consisted of 70 souls. And they went down to Mitzrayim. Where were the other souls? Where were the thousands upon thousands of souls that Avram taught the belief in one God to? Where did they get lost? The answer is that Avram wasn't interested in being Megayer them. They didn't have to become part of the nation of Israel. He was interested in teaching them the honest truth about the worship of one God. So that these Bnei Noach would desist from violating one of the most severe Isurim, in the case of a Ben Noach, it's a capital crime, of Avodah Zarah. So out of, in a sense, it's just a very strange phenomenon, if you ask me, that Avram is preaching to the masses, but he's not asking them to convert. He's giving them a belief. He wants them to get rid of their idols, because within the context of Sheva Mitzvahs Bnei Noach, they have to believe in one God. They have to reject the idols. So Avraham Avinu is doing for them whatever he can for them. But he's not going to ask them to be Megayer.
It's like a professor in university who's a biologist or whatever. He's teaching biology for the purpose of, you know, giving you some biology knowledge, but he doesn't want you to necessarily become a biologist and work in the lab.
That's right. You don't have to be a professional Jew, so to speak, Avram says. You don't have to convert to Judaism. All I'm asking you is to be a fine, upstanding citizen of a Ben Noach category that observes his mitzvahs. You don't have to take on more mitzvahs. I'm not going to be a guy of you. That's not my goal. Remain amongst the nations of the world, but let's change the tides over here so that people begin to rethink the idea of idolatry and hopefully reject it and throw it out. So again, there may be other sources which, as you indicate very well, describe the Geirus process that Avram was being Megayer, but we don't see that in the sources that we're looking at. The sources that we're looking at omit Geirus. And therefore it's no surprise that a Nefesh HaRos B'Charon never calculates into the Kehillah of Klal Yisrael, into the community of Israel. And it's only 70 souls that go down to Mitzrayim. Where were all the other tens of thousands? They had their own nations, and they lived in their own geographic locations. They were totally disinterested and separate from Abraham. However, do you see the next paragraph? We're coming towards the end, if you can hang in there a little bit longer. The Targum says, on the Pasuk HaNefesh Asher Asu B'Charon, Nafshosa Dishibdu La'oraisa. These were the souls that became committed to the Torah. It sounds like Avram was doing a lot more here, accomplishing a greater task than just teaching Torah knowledge. But rather he was teaching them to be Meshavi themselves to the Torah, which is called Kabbalas Ol Malchus Shamayim. Rashi says in his Pirush al Torah, "Hanefesh asher asu b'charon shechnisan takas kamfei hashchina." Now the tides are changing a little bit. Now the direction is to lead us to the conclusion that there was a Geirus process, and Avraham was being Megayer all these disciples of his. And Rashi in his Pirush al Chumash says, "Hechnisan takas kamfei hashchina." That phrase, Ichnisan Tachas Kafei Shechina, is a phrase that's uniquely dedicated to Geirus.
Why?
Again, I can't tell you why historically, but I'm just saying it, you'll see it all over the place. That Ichnisan Tachas Kafei Shechina, that when you become a Jew, you get closer to the protection of the Shechina. Also, it says over there in the Targum, it says, Avram Megayeres Hanoshim, Vesor Megayeres Hanoshim. So again, are we meant to take an attitude that this is not literal and it's just symbolic? Targum Yonason says, "On Nefesh Sharos B'Charon, Nafshosa Di Giru B'Charon." So when you stack up the evidence here, there's a lot more. The weight of the evidence is in favor of a Geirus process, even though the Rambam doesn't mention it. It says in Ovester Rabbi Nosson, Shechnisan Tachas Kamfei Hashchina. Which means Geirus. If you take a look at the Rambam at the beginning of the 13th chapter of the Hilchos Yisurei Biyah, you will see that the words Hechnisan Tachas Kamfei Hashchina and Nichnas Kamfei Hashchina are uniquely related to Geirus. That's exactly the fancy modern Hebrew way of saying Geirus. There's a Medrash Rabbah which I found says Elu Geirum Shegiru. The Sifri on the Pasuk Ahavta Hashem Elokecha Ahavaso Ahavto Al Kol Abrios, make him, meaning God, beloved to all the creatures. Kavron Avinu Keinyan Shenema V'es HaNefesh Hashosu B'Charon. So in Ovester of Nosim, it says that he was Megayer them. But in the Medrash Rabbah, it goes even further. It's the Sifri, excuse me, the Ahavtas Hashem Elokecha. This is Avraham Avinu. that he brought so many people to the belief in one God. As it says, V'anefesh asher osu b'charon. Now let's read a little bit further in the Sifri. It says we're going to pass on to the last paragraphs here. Valo im miskansim kol boi olam livros yitush echor lachas for neshama eni yicholim. How can it be a nefesh asher asu b'charon? They created nefashos. You gather together all the geniuses and all the scientists of the entire world, and they can't even create one little mosquito and to put a life force inside of it. So what does it mean? A nefesh asher asu b'charon el malame shahoya avram avinu megayram umachnisam tachas hashvina. So then, what happens is that all these people became part of the Jewish nation. Am I right? According to all these last sources, these, you know, whether it's the Targum Yonason or the regular Targum, whether it's the Rashi in his Pirush al Torah. In all these different sources, it says clearly that Avram was Megayer these disciples. The Yesh Lachkar Lefi Osa Megarshim Ashmosu Geris Vam Shalo Geris Uay Solahochel Alem the Geris Shal Ger Toshov O Geris Vam Shlishki Yisrael. What was that status of all these Goyim who were Mizgayer? Did they have a status of Yisrael? Well, maybe they had the status of a Ger Toshov. Because basically, what's a Ger Toshev? A Ger Toshev is someone who's a Ben Noach, who's dedicated to observe the seven mitzvahs of Bnei Noach. But he makes a declaration in front of the Beis Din that I know that God gave us the seven laws of Noach, and therefore I'm observing it. That's called a Ger Toshev. He comes publicly in front of a Beis Din, and he says, I commit myself to observe the seven Noahide laws because it was given by God. Now, if this be the case, then maybe we could say the following. I'm just thinking out loud with you. If the gears before Matan Torah maxed out at Zion Mitzvah Bnei Noach, meaning to give the gear the status of a Ger Toshev, then once again, it really means that Avram Avinu was reaching out to Goyim to make them into believers in one God.
But all Goyim are Bnei Noach. So therefore, there's no Geirus.
No, I'm saying the Geirus that took place before Matan Torah was equivalent to what we call a Ger Toshev. Means he takes upon himself to the obligation, he accepts upon himself to worship to observe the seven mitzvahs. Right. So he still remains a God.
Right, so there's technically no Goyim, because all the Goyim are required to do the seven Bnei Noach.
You're saying that if every guy did what he had to do, right, then every guy would be called a Ger Toshev.
Yeah. All Avram's doing is reminding them that they have to do these seven Noahide.
Correct. And that's going to explain why we don't find that the numbers of Klal Yisrael were beefed up, were expanded by all these thousands upon thousands and tens of thousands of Gerim. Where are they? How come they weren't part of Klal Yisrael? They were Ger Toshev. Ger Toshev was a guy. And the Brisker Rav on the Torah in Parshas Bo has a long arichus to prove that there was Gerus Mamish with Nei Matan Torah. So we were assuming there's no such thing as Gerus before Matan Torah. You have Gerus for Zayim Mitzvahs Bnei Noach, but no. But if the Torah hasn't been given yet, where's the 613
mitzvahs? How is that Gerus? If every human being at that time is required to follow those seven laws, then they're not, choosing to do something else. As opposed to today, where, there's Yidin and Goyin, and the goyim don't have to keep the laws of the Jews. They can do their own thing. So, imagine the entire world was Eden, right? Abraham would only be providing them by those 613 mitzvahs.
He wasn't providing them, because the geiros before Matan Torah was the geiros of the Ger Tosha. That's only Zion mitzvahs B'nai Noach.
So it was again.
Who was observing the Tariq mitzvahs? Avram. He gave it over to his son Yitzchak, to Yaakov, and then to the 12 Shvatim.
Right.
It was a very select group, a very limited group.
So those are
of a circle of people who were observing the Torah itself.
Right. So everyone else is doing what they're required to do. Therefore, they're no geiros.
Correct. And that would explain why at the time of Yetziah. At the time of Yerida L'Mitzrayim, what we find is the small number of 70. Where are all the Jews? The answer, they weren't Jews. They were Ger Toshavs, which means they remain in practice, in theory, in reality, in ideology, they remain Goyim. They're good Goyim. Ger Toshav is a good guy. We have to feed him. We have to support him. We have to give him tzedakah. So let's just take quickly a look at the Brisker Rav here. That's the Chidush HaGriz al Torah, who gives a long explanation to prove that there was Geirus Mamish the way we know it before Matan Torah. And again, I'm not going to go through all your proofs. I don't have them here. But let's focus on one proof. It says, Liyosecha Lokim Lezarecha Acharecha. This pasuk is quoted in the Gemara in Yevamos Daf Kuf and is interpreted as a warning against intermarriage. I mean, again, if we had time, we would go through the Gemara Makis line by line to figure this all out, and there's really one line in the Gemara that's very ambiguous. But be that as it may, the Gemara says that the pasuk Leo Sechalo Kim Lazarcha Harecha is a warning not to marry out of the faith, not to intermarry. Because if you intermarry, a male intermarries with a non-Jewish female, the child has which status? Again, the father is Jewish and the mother is not Jewish. What's the status of the child? He's a goy. So basically what you're doing is, you're not taking the Torah and passing it on to your children because your children are goyim. When a Jewish man marries a non-Jewish woman, the children have no relationship halachically, according to Jewish law, with their father, even though he's their biological father. So already in the case of Avraham Avinu, this pasuk Leos Lechol Kim Lezarachach Recha is being said to Avraham Avinu, and he and his children are being commanded to marry in the faith, within the fold, meaning other Jews. Then it must mean that there's some geirus before Matan Torah, says the Brisker Rav. Because if there's no geirus before Matan Torah, then what's God trying to preserve over here when he says, Liyosecha Elokim Ulezarecha Acharecha? You know, don't marry out of the faith. Well, that's only if there's a nation of Jews who are defined and identified as Jews, and they have children, their children are Jewish. So there must have been geirus. However, what's the nature of geirus before Matan Torah? I mean, geirus means to accept upon yourself 613 mitzvahs. So here, in the last paragraph, we present the opinion that geirus has two parts to it. One part is to create a Jewish people, to join the Jewish people, I should say. And the other part is to fulfill the 613 mitzvahs. And we find by Avraham Avinu that he was Mekayim Kol HaTorah Kulo Korim Shenitza, all 613. Mashma sheyesh mashmaut v'kiyum l'chol osa ma'aseh mitzvahs. I mean, if the Gemara is telling us about Avraham Avinu that he was Mekayim Kol Tarkula. What was it? Just the act of technical robotic act? I mean, it must be a mitzvah. It must be a kiyum of some sort. We're lauding it. We're praising it. Avraham Avinu was dedicated to all the mitzvahs even before they were given. So if you take a look in the Parshas Drachim, which is authored by the Mishnah Melech, he goes into long-winded hakiris. He does somersaults in the sky. Where the Avos, they have a din of Yisrael, do they have a din of Ben Noach? I mean, it's a long discussion in the Parshas Drachim. But it would just seem, from a lot of the sources that we saw, that there was Geirus before Matan Torah. And therefore the Avos, we could say, were Jews. But it's not clear exactly what kind of Geirus and how Geirus operated before Matan Torah to create this thing called Mishpachas Yisrael. That for marriage purposes and for Doros, we have to stay within the fold and we're not allowed to marry out of the fold. And on top of that, you have Tarayag Mitzvahs, which perhaps, maybe the Geirus before Matan Torah would allow the non-Jew, who's now becoming Jewish to some extent, to fulfill all the mitzvahs of the Torah, all 613, as an Eino Mitzvah V'yosa. Means voluntarily. There's no obligation on his part, because the Torah hasn't been given yet. But it's a Geirus that's, how shall I say, it's a partial Geirus. A very large part. It's not just a small partial gears. Not a little segment. It's a major chunk of the part. Number one, that they become part of Mishpachas Yisrael. They can marry into the Jewish faith. Their children are Jewish and they should be Jewish. And not Hashon that they should ever considering marrying out of the faith. And more than that, what's most dramatic about this gears is that in its result, you have an ability on the part of a non-Jew to fulfill all 613 mitzvahs and get scarred for that. And why? Because he undergoes this Geirus process. So getting back to our Nefesh HaShoras HaBacharon, it would seem from all the above that Pasuk is referring to Geirus. Even though, as I said at the outset, Reish Lakish and Sanhedrin doesn't mention a word about Geirus. The Rambam doesn't mention Geirus per se. So this remains pretty much an open question. You know, was the Geirus before Matan Torah? What was the status of the Avos? Who was the Nefesh HaShoras HaBacharon? I have vested interest in saying that there was no Geirus for the Nefesh HaShoras HaBacharon, despite all the sources that we saw. Because otherwise, where did they get lost? Why was the Jewish community made up of one family if all these other multitudes of people were misguided? It doesn't make any sense.
Another share.
Yeah, that's for a different time.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you so much. And
yeah.
What is that, a phone?